Okay, so our next speaker is Steve Simon, and he's going to talk to us about knots, world lines, and quantum computation on the blackboard, old style.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. So the last few decades have seen some remarkable convergences between a field of mathematics, the field of topology, and several fields of physics, including quantum physics, particle physics, condensed matter physics, and in particular, quantum computation. And that's what I hope to tell you about in the next 40 minutes or so. The idea of connecting topology to physics is actually not a new one. It goes back into the 1800s with one of our heroes, Lord Kelvin. Kelvin, around 1867, was working with a very close friend of his, Peter Tate, also a very good scientist. And they were interested in the time in studying a certain phenomena of fluid mechanics. And that phenomenon is a smoke ring, a very simple thing that they were all familiar with. You know, back in the old days, they used to do this thing called smoking cigarettes. Don't do it anymore. But so everyone knew what a smoke ring was, and I'll just draw one on the board here. It's an invisible ring in the middle of the air, and the fluid of the smoke flows around the ring this way, and then the whole ring comes out of the board at you. Now, Peter Tate asked himself whether he could build a machine to blow these smoke rings and then they could study it more carefully. It turns out to be extremely easy to build these machines if you've never done it yourself. You take a big drum like a garbage can and you fill it with smoke, and if you hit the back, a smoke ring will come out. It's really easy to make a smoke ring that's about a meter in diameter, and the smoke ring can travel 30 or 40 meters through the air before it dissipates. He showed this machine to Lord Kelvin, who was really impressed with it, and he had a number of simultaneous epiphanies. The first one became known as Kelvin's circulation theorem, and we still teach it in undergraduate fluid dynamics. The essence of the theorem is that if it were not for the friction in the air, if it were not for the viscosity or dissipation in the air, then the smoke ring configuration of fluid flow would last forever. It would just keep spinning around and around and around, be completely stable, and go on forever. Now, that got Kelvin thinking, where could he find a fluid with no friction, with no viscosity at all, so the smoke rings could continue forever? Now, such fluids, such perfect fluids, do exist. We call them superfluids, and they exist at ultra-low temperature. But Kelvin didn't know about any of these things because in the 1800s, they didn't have any cryogenics. But he thought he knew about a perfect fluid with no friction. It's a famous mistake in the literature, and the mistake is known as ether. So let me remind you what ether was supposed to be. Ether is supposed to be this perfect frictionless fluid that fills all of space, and its purpose was to carry electromagnetic waves through the environment. And the reason they thought such a thing should exist is because they understood a lot about waves. They knew when you saw a wave on water, what you're really seeing is water sloshing back and forth, and when you heard a wave in the air, what you were really hearing was air moving back and forth. And they knew that light was a wave. They didn't see anything moving back and forth, but they hypothesized that such a substance should exist. And actually, the invention of ether goes back several hundred years earlier to René Descartes, who said, "I think, therefore it is." That was a joke. He just made this stuff up, and ever since, everyone believed in it all the way through the 1800s until it was destroyed by Einstein later. Anyway, so Kelvin believed in this ether stuff, this perfect frictionless fluid. He knew it had to be extremely frictionless because he could see light from stars extremely far away, and if there were any friction or dissipation in the fluid, you wouldn't be able to see the light from the stars. And he had his circulation theorem that says if you have a perfect fluid, these smoke rings would last forever. So that got him thinking, well, what is a smoke ring in the ether? What would it mean to have a smoke ring in the ether? And he came to a really remarkable conclusion that this smoke ring is actually an atom, like maybe a hydrogen atom. And you could have a more complicated fluid flow configuration, something maybe that looks like this, two linked rings, and then the fluid flows around this ring this way, and the fluid flows around this ring this way, and by the circulation theorem, this configuration of fluid flow would be stable for all time, and maybe this is a hydrogen molecule. And then you could have an even more complicated configuration, maybe something like this, and maybe like this. Am I going to get this right? Like that. Knot it, some sort of knot that you can draw, and then the fluid flows around it like this, and the fluid flows around it like this, and the fluid flows around it like this, and so forth. And that configuration of fluid flow would also be stable forever. And maybe this is a more complicated atom, like lithium. Now, this sounds completely ridiculous to us right now because we know that atoms have nothing to do with fluid flow in the ether. We know ether doesn't even exist. We know atoms are made up of electrons, protons, and neutrons. So it makes no sense to be talking about it now. But back then in the 1800s, this actually sounded like a really good idea. And many of the most serious scientists of the age thought it was really, this was the way forward, that this was potentially the truth as to why it is we have atoms. People like Maxwell, Kirchhoff, Helmholtz, they all were very interested in this theory. After about 10 years of work on this theory, they realized that it wasn't going anywhere, it didn't predict anything useful, and they mostly had thrown it away. But one person held on to the theory for a very long time, and that person was Peter Tate. And Peter Tate thought that what he had to do in order to really understand this vortex theory of the atom was to build up a periodic table of all possible knots. This is the simplest knot, this is the next most simple knot, this is the next most simple knot, and by building a periodic table of the knots, he would learn something about the periodic table of the elements. So he devoted much of the remainder of his scientific career into understanding knots, and he became the father of the modern mathematical theory of knots, what we call knot theory, which became a very rich and important field of mathematics, a field of topology, later on. Now, as it came towards the end of Peter Tate's life, around 1900 or so, he got extremely depressed that he had wasted his entire life on this, because despite the fact that he had learned an enormous amount about knots, and he had built up his periodic table of the knots, and he had learned lots and lots about mathematics of knots, he was no closer to understanding anything about the periodic table, for obvious reasons, because the theory just isn't correct. So he died rather depressed. In addition, there were some rather serious personal tragedies, and he felt that he had really wasted all of this time. What he didn't realize is that his work on knot theory was going to be extremely important in both mathematics and important in physics much later on, but he didn't live to see that happen. So I'm going to take a little bit of a detour into knot theory first and explain to you what it is that Peter Tate understood that's so important, and we'll come back to physics, and we'll see how it applies to physics a little bit later. So the main thing that Peter Tate asked when he was studying knots is a very simple question. How do you know when two knots are the same or when they're different? So for example, if we draw another knot like this, a very simple knot, is it the same as this one or is it different? In other words, can this thing be unentangled and turned into this without cutting any of the strands? Now, it's fairly easy to see that all I've done is I've folded this over, and I could just unfold it and make it back into this. So we say that these two are equivalent knots, or we say they're topologically equivalent. And if it was a more complicated knot like this, there's no way to unfold this and turn it into this. So it looks like an easy problem to solve, but if you have a really complicated knot, it gets rapidly extremely difficult to tell when two knots can be turned into each other and when they can't. So Peter Tate realized that what you need is some tools in order to figure out, to help you, mathematical tools to help you figure out when two things are the same and when they're different. So the main tool that he understood, although he didn't use these words, the words were put on it a little bit later, is the idea of a mathematical knot invariant. Knot invariant. And a knot invariant is nothing more than a mapping from a knot as an input, a picture of a knot like I've drawn on the board over there, to some mathematical output, like a number or a polynomial or something of that sort. And the mapping goes via a set of rules. And the important thing is that in order to be a knot invariant, the rules have to be cooked up in such a way that topologically equivalent knots put into the rule always give the same output. So if you have two really complicated knots and you don't know if they're the same or different, you put them into the rules, if you get different outputs, you know immediately that these two things cannot be deformed into each other in any way without cutting, okay? So in order to show you how these knot invariants work, I'm actually gonna define one on the board. I'm actually gonna do a calculation, show you how they work to convince you that they exist and how it is that they operate. So the knot invariant I'm going to define is known as the Kaufman invariant. It's also known as it's very close to what's known as the Jones polynomial. Von Jones is a very brilliant mathematician and New Zealander. He won the Fields Medal for his work on knot theory. The Fields Medal is like the Nobel Prize of mathematics. Lewis Kaufman, who also has his name associated with this, is also a very good mathematician. He did something that's at least as important, which is that he made it simple enough so that almost anyone can understand it, which I think was a great improvement over what Lewis Kaufman, Von Jones had done before. So in order to define the Kaufman invariant, you start by picking a number. A, we'll call the number A. A stands for a number. Like that. And then there's only two rules of the Kaufman invariant. The first rule is that if you ever have a loop of string with nothing going through it, you can replace that loop by a mathematical number, minus a squared minus a to the minus 2. And that combination occurs so frequently, we give it a name, we call it D. Okay? So a loop is worth D. That's the first rule. The second rule is the harder rule. The second rule tells you that if you have a picture where two strings cross over each other like this, you can replace that picture by a sum of two pictures. So we're going to be doing algebra with pictures. We'll take one picture and we'll replace it by two pictures. One picture has the two strings going in a vertical direction, and the other picture has the two strings going in the horizontal direction. The first picture having a coefficient of A, and the second picture having a coefficient of A inverse. Okay, so we're going to work with sums and sums of different pictures, and we're going to give them coefficients out front of this factor A. I'm going to draw, these are the only two rules we have to keep track of. I'm going to draw a third, which is the same as the second. It's just going to be exactly the same picture. It's just all of the diagrams are going to be rotated by 90 degrees. And the reason I'm doing this is because it's easier to draw the picture twice than to ask you to rotate your head at a later point. Okay. All right. So what I'm going to do now is, before your very eyes, I'm going to evaluate the Kaufman invariant of this figure eight looking knot right here. So what you do is you examine this picture, and you see that there's a place in this picture where two strings cross over each other, right there in that little dotted loop. And you see that the sense of this crossing is from top left to bottom right is over, like this top rule here. So we can replace that, exactly as this top rule here, top crossing rule tells us, by A times a vertical plus A inverse times a horizontal. And then the rest of the picture is the same on the left as it is on the right. So on the top here, it connects up. So I connect up here. And on the bottom, it crosses under and then connects up. So crosses under like this and connects up here. Crosses under and connects up here. Is it clear what I just did? Okay, good. So this is the most important moment of the talk. So if you can follow this, you're in good shape. All right, so these pictures, we just keep going and we keep applying the rule. So there's another crossing here. And this crossing is like this one here. It's the opposite sense of the crossing. I'll bring down this A here, open up a bracket. And then we have an A. I'm going to do this really quick. It kind of looks like this. Crossing is horizontal first, and then an A inverse. I guess it looks kind of like this. And then this A inverse comes down here, and I get an A times this plus an A inverse times, I guess, this. Okay, everyone happy with that? Okay, good. All right, so now what I have is I have a bunch of pictures and there are no crossings. So every picture has just loops in it, and each loop is worth the value D. So each time I see a loop, I replace it by D. So I get, here's A times A, so that's A squared. Two loops is D squared, two Ds. A cancels A inverse, there's one loop, so I have D. A cancels A inverse, there's three loops, so that's D cubed. And then A to the minus 2 plus A to the minus 2, and two loops is D squared. Okay, we're almost there. We just need one tiny piece of algebra. You'll see that A squared and A to the minus 2 is equal to minus D by this here. So these two pieces here, this piece and this piece, can be put together to give us minus D cubed. This minus D cubed cancels this D cubed, and at the end of the day, you get D, right? Ta-da. Okay, so why is that so exciting? The reason that's so exciting is because secretly, we knew that this knot was just a loop. And a loop is worth D. And even though we folded over the loop to make it look a lot more complicated, it still gives us the output of D. That's how knot invariants worked. I could have folded over this knot 100 times. I still would have gotten D. No matter how complicated it looked, it always would have given me D. So this makes it very easy to use this type of tool to help you distinguish when knots are the same and when they're different. Now, if you think about it a little bit harder, if you're trying to distinguish very complex knots from each other, you want to try to put them in the rule and see what comes out. But you'll realize that it actually starts to become rapidly extremely difficult to evaluate the Kaufman invariant of complicated knots. Why is that? Well, in this picture here, we had two crossings. We ended up with four diagrams. If we had three crossings, we would have eight diagrams. Four crossings, 16 diagrams. If it was 100 crossings, we would have had a billion, billion, billion diagrams, some enormous number. Even the world's biggest computer working for 100 years would not be able to evaluate the Kaufman invariant of a complicated knot with 100 crossings. And it actually turns out to be very easy to draw a picture of a knot with 100 crossings, and you'd never be able to calculate the Kaufman invariant of that knot. Okay, so this is something that is computationally complex. It's exponentially difficult in the language that Andrew Steen was using just a few moments ago. All right, so how are we going to relate this to physics? We need a couple of ideas which are very typically used in physics, and they sort of stem from around the time that Einstein was doing his work. The first idea that we need is that space and time really aren't that different, so we like to draw what are known as space-time diagrams. So here, let's imagine we have a two-dimensional system, flat plane like a tabletop. Our particles are going to move around on a tabletop. We'll put two particles on our tabletop, and I'm going to draw time in the vertical direction. Now, if I imagine taking one particle around the other on the tabletop, I can draw that like this as a space-time diagram. Did I get this right? Yeah, okay, so two particles went around each other. I guess they went around each other once and a half times. In the space-time diagram, as time goes forwards, they move around each other. Everyone happy with that? Okay, the other thing we need, I guess, really comes from, in some sense, it comes from Einstein's E equals MC squared, which everyone is well, at least they've heard it. and it's the principle that that energy and mass are really the same thing, and often they can be traded for each other. So in this particular case, we might imagine putting in energy as a photon or something like that, and then that photon can disappear and produce a particle and an antiparticle pair which have mass. So let's do that. Let's put in a photon. So photon comes in, energy, and that creates a particle-antiparticle pair like this. We typically draw, so particle is an arrow going forward, and antiparticle is a particle with the opposite arrow. It's sort of another complicated part of relativity that a particle going forward in time is like an antiparticle going backwards in time, but that's not really that important. So anyway, so here's a prediction, a picture of energy going in and particle and antiparticle coming out. Now we can bring them back together again, and we can allow them to annihilate and emit their energy again as a photon. You can kind of see from this picture where I'm about to go with this, right? That this is starting to look a little bit like a knot. So here's the surprising thing, and it's surprising enough, I'll write it down on the board. Particles exist, particular particles exist in 2 plus 1 dimensions, 2 plus 1D. What do I mean by 2 plus 1 dimensions? It means that they live on flat surfaces, and then plus 1 means plus time. So they're moving around in two dimensions. They're moving around on a two-dimensional surface, and then they move around in time, such that the probability of annihilation at the end of a knot, the probability of annihilation, annihilation equals the Kaufman invariant squared. And in order to define the Kaufman invariant, you need to pick a number, so you have to choose the right number. I won't tell you exactly how you do it, but it's Kaufman invariant for a given value of A. So, here we might imagine the following process. Here's your two-dimensional surface. You put in some energy, create your particle-antiparticle pairs, like this. Then you imagine taking one particle around another particle like this, bring them back together at the end, bring them back together at the end. Again, time is running vertically here. And the question is, do they reannihilate and emit as photons, or do they not? Question mark. What happens? Do they reannihilate to give off their energy as photons, or do they refuse to give off their energy as photons? In order to find out if they do or they do not, you calculate the Kaufman invariant, you square it, and that tells you the probability of them reannihilating, up to some normalization that I'm brushing under the rug. So physical systems with this property are known as topological quantum field theories, or topological phases of matter. And you might think that it's a little surprising that such a thing can exist in the first place. Why? Well, we're used to the idea that the proper, you know, the dynamics of a particle moving around depends on things like how far it is from another particle, or how fast it's moving, or, you know, did it wiggle around or something like that. Here, I'm telling you the only thing that matters is the knot it formed. I could have drawn this knot like this, or I could have drawn a little tiny knot like this. As long as the knot is topologically equivalent, oops, is that the same? That's not the same. No, it's the same. It's the same. It is the same, yeah. Or it could have been a great big knot, or they could have been, you know, short and thin, or large and fat. As long as it's the same knot, as long as they can be formed continuously into each other, the probability of annihilation ends up being the same at the end of the day. Okay, now, why is this interesting from a computational perspective? Well, suppose you wanted to calculate the Kaufman invariant of some very complicated knot. See how you would do that. Okay, here's your two-dimensional system. You imagine you have your topological matter in your lab, and you put in some photons. So you put in some photons here, and you create your particle-antiparticle pairs like this, as many as you need. Then you take these particles and you drag them around. You drag them around to some very complicated knot, which I will draw schematically as a big scribble. Okay? And then at the end of the day, you bring them back together, and you can see, do they annihilate or do they not annihilate? So you measure it once, and you write down, yes, it annihilated this time. Then you do it again. You do the same experiment over and over and over and over and over, and you can measure the probability that they, in any one given instance, whether they do annihilate or they do not, and you can measure the Kaufman invariant squared. That's very interesting, because we just determined that determining the Kaufman invariant of a complicated knot is something that the world's biggest computer could never do even in 100 years. And now we have a way, a physical way, to take these quantum mechanical particles in our laboratory and measure the Kaufman invariant. This topological quantum field theory computer has computational abilities which are beyond any current computer ever made. Okay? Now you might say, well, that's terrific. But I'm not all that interested in calculating Kaufman invariants. It's a little bit of, you know, it's kind of fun to determine knots, distinguish knots from each other, but maybe it's not that useful. It turns out that the power of this computer is equivalent to any quantum computer you could build, that this has exactly the same computational power as any quantum computer, so it can do all the tasks that Andrew was talking about in the previous talk. It can define periods, it can factor large numbers, it can simulate proteins and chemistry processes and so forth, at least in principle, if we manage to build one of these things, which, of course, no one has managed to do yet. But, you know, that's a minor detail, I suppose. So you might ask, well, why is it that this is actually an attractive way to try to build a quantum computer? And in order to understand that, we have to think for a second about one of the things that Andrew was saying at the very end, that one of the real problems with quantum computation is protection from very small errors. Every single operation you do has to be precise to 1 part in 10 to the 9. And, you know, if you might imagine you have a, you know, one of his spins, his little magnets, if a little bit of noise gets into your system, say a very low energy photon comes in, or a little vibration into your container comes in, it can tilt this a little bit. It can turn it into, you know, a slightly different angle. And then you've lost your precision of 1 part in 10 to the 9. It's not quite pointing at the same angle anymore. And so you have a problem. You've created an error, and you have to go to great lengths to somehow fix that error. Let's think about what happens in this computer here. Suppose some noise comes into the system, say a photon, noise. It hits one of these particles, and what can it do? Well, it can take this particle and it can shake it around like that. But as long as the knot that I made hasn't been changed, I've done exactly the same computation. Okay? As I can shake everything around as much as I want, as long as I don't change the topology of the knot. As long as I made the correct knot, I've done the right computation. The only thing that will cause me trouble is if I hit with enough noise such that this goes all the way around a bunch of other guys like this, and now I've made a different knot, and I've done the wrong computation. So this type of quantum computer is inherently immune to small amounts of noise. And so this is one of the strategies that people have been thinking about using for building a quantum computer that is immune to noise, or at least immune to small enough amounts of noise. Okay? So far, so good? Okay. So let me do a little bit of honesty and advertising before I go on, because I don't want everyone to go home and think about this again and say, oh, wait a second, he lied to me. So I'm going to come clean. I'm going to explain something here. And I also promised the next speaker that I would go through this, so because he's going to use it later. I'm going to evaluate just a little piece of a knot like this, try to evaluate the Kaufman invariant of this little piece of knot. Assume that the end points here are connected up in some way, but I'm not so interested in what's going on over there. I'm just going to evaluate the Kaufman invariant of this little piece of a knot. So to evaluate this, I'll do this very quickly. I guess it's the top rule over here we have to apply. So we get A times replaced by horizontal plus A inverse times replaced by, vertical and horizontal, right? Yeah. And then, so this one comes down like this, and this goes over like this, and then this comes down like this, and goes over like this, and comes down like this. Everyone happy with that? Yeah? Okay, so this thing here can be pulled straight into a straight line, and this thing here is a loop, so it gets replaced by D. And so the whole thing becomes AD plus A inverse times a straight line. And AD plus A inverse is mathematically just, with a little bit of algebra, it's minus A cubed times a straight line. Okay, so at this point, now some people probably have already seen why you should be upset with me and why you think I lied to you. So I promised you that two things that can be deformed into each other without cutting should give you the same Kaufman invariant. And now you see this thing here and this thing here have Kaufman invariants that differ by a prefactor of minus A cubed. So that looks like they're different. So what's going on? Did I lie to you or did I not lie to you? The answer is I did not lie to you. But what's going on here is that this picture and this picture are actually not equivalent. You can't deform one into the other. And the way to see this is to think of these strings as actually not being infinitely thin strings, but think of them as sort of thick ribbons or like a garden hose or something. So let me draw this as having some thickness here. It has some thickness, like this. And you know that if you take a garden hose and you try to pull it straight, what you get is actually this. I'm not going to be able to do this now. Something like this, and then like this. There. You get something twisted on. Everyone had this experience of trying to straighten a garden hose? Yeah, okay. Okay, and then what you have over on the right-hand side here is straight. So this factor of minus A cubed is actually accounting for the fact that a twisted piece of string is not the same as a straight piece of string. Okay, so that's why these are different. So now you know everything that you need to know to go home, pick your favorite knot, and evaluate the Kaufman invariant of your favorite knot. And I know that everyone does have a favorite knot, so you can spend your time doing that. So you will expect that there will be a difference between a twisted string and a non-twisted string. Actually, there's a couple of interesting things about this argument here. First of all, why do we expect a factor of minus A cubed out front? It turns out for every topological quantum field theory we're interested in, this factor A is just a complex phase, e to the I theta, something of magnitude 1 but having some complex angle. So that means this prefactor here is just some phase. Okay? If you take a particle, particularly a particle with a spin, and you rotate that spin, which is what's going on here. The particle is rotating around itself, and as it goes forward in time, it's rotating around itself. When you take a particle with a spin, if you rotate it around itself, you pick up a quantum mechanical phase. This is one of the principles of spin in quantum mechanics. If you rotate a spin, you get a phase. So that's exactly what this phase is doing. Another interesting thing about this diagram here is that it actually gives you a nice proof of this famous theorem called the spin statistics theorem. So the spin statistics theorem tells you that when you have a particle with a spin, you rotate the particle around, you pick up a phase. That's what spin does. Statistics is what happens when you take two identical particles and you exchange their position. That's what's happened here. We had a particle here and a particle here, and you switch their positions. The point is that the spin statistics theorem says the phase you should get by exchanging the particles should be the same as the phase you get when you rotate a single particle. And that's exactly what we're seeing here. We're taking this particle, you're straightening out its world line, and the exchange here turns into a twist here. So spin and statistics are connected by just straightening a world line, as we've seen here. Okay, I have about 4 minutes left. Maybe I'll steal an extra minute. So I want to try to make things a little bit more connected to what Andrew was talking about before, because it's, you know, I tell you that, you know, that you can build a quantum computer out of these knots, but I don't tell you how you make a mapping of what I'm talking about to what Andrew was talking about. He was talking about bits with 0 and 1, 2 possible states, and up spins and down spins and so forth. So what are the 2 possible states in my system? Well, let's imagine we have our two-dimensional system, some disk here, and it has some particles and some antiparticles in it. So I'll draw the particles and the antiparticles like this. So now let me draw it again, actually, because I'm going to need 2 of them. These are supposed to look identical. So they look identical in every possible way. Anything that you could measure locally in these two systems look exactly the same, but they're different. One of them represents spin up, and one of them represents spin down. So this one will be spin up, or a 0-bit, and this one will be spin down, or a 1-bit, or vice versa. How can they be different? The way they can be different is they have different space-time histories. This one could have come like this, whereas this one could have come like this. Those are topologically different space-time histories. In topological quantum field theories, the system remembers its space-time history. And how do I know that these two states are going to be actually physically different states? The way you can tell that these things have to be physically different states is actually by doing some physical process to them and seeing that the experiment gives you a different result. So what physical process do we do? Well, we take this particle and we close them up and we see if they reannihilate. And if I do the same thing over here, see if they reannihilate. Well, to find out if this one reannihilates, I just look at the knot I formed. The knot I formed here was 2 loops, and so that is worth d squared. Whereas the knot I formed here, although it's kind of funny shaped, it's just 1 loop, and so that is worth d. So you can tell immediately that these two are physically different. Because they have different space-time histories, they are physically different states, and they can be thought of as the 0 and 1 state, or the spin-up or the spin-down state. So that's how the translation goes, more or less, from the bit story to the knot story. And if you want to do the 2-qubit gate that Andrew was talking about, you do something. Okay, now I'm going to make 1 qubit here by making two particle antiparticle pairs, and another qubit over here by making another 2. And then if I want to do a gate that acts on 2 qubits, I just have to entangle the knots between them and make the appropriate knot between these 2 bits. And you'll end up, if you make the appropriate knot, which of course I'm not going to draw properly here, you end up with the particles, again, your 4 particles, 2 particles, 2 antiparticles, 2 particles, 2 antiparticles, which is exactly the same as starting with your particles in their initial states and applying the certain gate, the certain operation to them, which does the 2-qubit operation that Andrew says we need in order to do our computation. How am I doing? No time left. Okay, I think I better stop there, but I'm happy to answer more questions, and if anyone doesn't have a question, you can ask me what physical systems have this property, which was on my next page.